I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, in partnership with Side Effects Public Media, we'll continue our community conversation about public health. We'll talk about the importance of sharing recovery stories. My guests are firefighter Brandon Dryman, Indiana Addiction Issues Coalition Director Brandon George, and Kelsey Phillips, who has been in recovery since 2013. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today in partnership with Side Effects Public Media about the importance of sharing recovery stories. This is part of our ongoing community conversation about important public health issues. If you want to join the conversation, if you have your own story to share, please give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are firefighter Brandon Dryman, Indiana Addiction Issues Coalition Director Brandon George, Kelsey Phillips, who worked with IU Health and has been in recovery since 2013. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
It's good to have you here. So we probably ought to start, and you know, the point of this program, as I said before we went on the air, is to share recovery stories and talk about why they matter. Before we get in, and each of you I know has a story to share, before we get into that, we probably ought to talk about what recovery is. Start with a definition of that. I'll start with Brandon George on that one.
Well, for me, I think recovery is about living life to my fullest potential. You know, a lot of times we focus on specific drugs and whether somebody is taking a drug or not taking a drug as whether or not that person is in recovery. But, you know, in healthcare, I think they call it social determinants. You look at the different areas of somebody's life and whether that's my interpersonal relationships, you know, with my family, with my kids, with my wife, you know, my education, my job, how are all those areas of life going for me? And that to me is kind of a good barometer of where my recovery's at. Obviously not using substances is part of that. But that alone usually isn't the entire factor, I guess.
Well, that's kind of what I wanted to get at. It is more than just the act or the decision to stop using substances, whether it's alcohol, drugs, whatever. Kelsey, you're looking at me and nodding your head, so I'm going to let you weigh in here.
Well, for me, what recovery means at work is different than what it means at home.
Like, yeah.
When I talk to patients at work, for me, it's very much about what works for you, what makes you happy, what makes your life better, and that is what I want to see you be able to do. But at home, you know, for me, that is very specific and measured, and I'm part of a fellowship, and it's really just about being a better person all the time, working towards that. And I think that a lot of people in recovery have that mindset, but ultimately it is about any individual having the best life that they can have and being the happiest they can be.
Brandon Dryman, we've got two Brandons on the program here, so we're probably going to have to use last names. You know, recovery implies that you're trying to recover something. In your case, what were you trying to recover?
I was trying to recover a sense of connection, I think. That part of what I lost were the connections with friends and family, because at that time in my mind, my friend and my family was alcohol and the substance that I was using. And over the course of that, you really lose out on a lot of relationships. And for me, it was getting back those connections, both on a personal level with family and friends, as well as with employment, and getting back on track at work as well. And that's really, for me, the key.
See Brandon George nodding his head up and down.
I really want to take a second to drive that point a little bit. People a lot smarter than me talk about addiction being a disease of isolation and how it separates us out from society. And it pushes people away. A lot of our behaviors do, and we really become isolated with the alcohol or the substance of choice, and that recovery really is about connection. It's about community. It's about the fellowship that Kelsey was talking about. It's about being engaged, and I think that's why a lot of the recovery programs that you see that are really effective, that have been effective for a really long time, have a social component to them, where you do get plugged back in with other people that are living healthy lives.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the importance of sharing recovery stories today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So, you know, with this, let's talk a bit, and I'll start with Kelsey on this one. Why is it important to share a recovery story?
I think that it's always important for anyone to be willing to talk about what's going on in their lives, especially if they're facing some sort of obstacle, because everyone, and especially right now, there's so much attention being put on addiction. It is a disease of isolation. So if I'm using, I'm not around people, I don't know that it's possible to recover unless I hear someone talk about it. But I think especially for women, it's really important because women tend to be underrepresented in recovery and to lack the same kind of social supports that men do in treatment centers and in the community at large, in their families. And I think that it's so important to talk about that, talk about those obstacles, those challenges, the solutions that people have found that work and don't work, because it's a personal journey.
Why is it that they're underrepresented in that way? Because the stereotype out there is that, you know, that women are at least, again, stereotypically supposed to be more connected with their feelings, more connected with their bodies than men are. Now, you know, that's the stereotype, and the stereotype isn't necessarily the truth.
Well, and I think that's a lot of the problem, is that there are lots of ideas about what a woman should be, mm-hmm. and a lot of those are so deeply ingrained. Women are supposed to be in charge of their families, so it might be harder for them to get the kind of help they need if they are tasked with staying home with children. Women are supposed to have it all together, so it's harder for them to stand up and say, you know, I did this. I struggle with this because I have to keep it all together so that my family has it all together. I have to appear as competent or more competent than my male counterparts at work because I have to struggle that much harder to get treated the same way. Or at least that tends to be the perception if it's not true. And a lot of women fall into that. It's a lot of I don't want to say pride, but a lot of that overcoming the obstacles of just being a woman.
Brandon George, one of the things that Kelsey, you know, in the argument, and I'm sure she wasn't limiting this, but it's important for other people to hear this, to hear that they're not alone. Is there also a therapeutic value for the person, herself or himself, who is attempting recovery, to share that story as well?
Absolutely. I think that a lot of times people are there. There's a couple different domains for recovery, and you've got health and you've got community. One of those is purpose as well. And being able to give back definitely helps build self-worth, self-esteem. We know, you know, there's just a, I don't like saying the word stigma anymore, because mm-hmm. it's almost stigmatizing in itself, it feels like, mm-hmm. but the best way to break through that is by sharing personal stories, by having a one-on-one connection with somebody that's experiencing the same issue as that person, or getting to know somebody that's been through the struggle of addiction and seeing that they're a good person and that they have a family and they're a PTO mom or that they're a coach. And for the person with the addiction issue, I think that it's really important that they're able to be honest and forthcoming with society, with their friends, with the people in the neighborhood, about their struggles and about being able to overcome them and providing hope to people who might be suffering in silence about this. As Kelsey mentioned, it's, you know, still really taboo. There's a lot of consequences that can be paid, whether it's a job, whether it's custody from children. I think that's a big reason that women are scared to come forward. You know, a lot of times males, their biggest consequence may be losing a job or getting arrested, but women and the family part, the kids part, will really make women hesitant, I think, to come forward about it.
Well, and I was thinking in the terms of, you know, there are several different religious traditions who argue that one of the, or it argues probably not the right word there, but would say that the reason for confession, for example, is that it is a way of relieving oneself of the burden of carrying this around. That's what I meant by the therapeutic value for the individual. I see Brandon Dryman nodding his head. I mean, was that the case for you?
Yeah, I think so. A lot of, particularly in the fire service, where we're supposed to be the problem solvers and not the problem havers, there is a certain level of shame with that that goes along with that vulnerability. And that's really, to me, what this all comes down to is the idea of a vulnerability. And we try and medicate that vulnerability or cover it up. And you can't do that in isolation. You may cover up the anxiety or the depression, but you also cover up the joy and the connections that you have in your life. And by being able to confront that vulnerability and say it, kind of takes it off your chest. And it also requires a lot of self-examination, which I think when you talk about things like confession, that's where that kind of comes from. You have to sit down and look inward to say, this is my issue or issues, and this is coming forward and saying them and getting it out there is important. And not just for the individual. I think it spreads outside of that to other people who may be having problems. You know, that goes a long way towards normalizing issues like this and validating other people's experiences who may be struggling too. And I think from a peer-to-peer aspect, which we see in things like recovery programs and professional peer programs, that's why they work, because we expose those vulnerabilities and let other people know that they're not alone.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the importance of sharing recovery stories here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Stephen has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hi. I just happened to tune into this. It's an amazing topic. I love it. I've been living it for the last 11 years, and everything that's been said is so right on. And you know, we don't promote the various ways of doing this, but connecting is crucial. You know, exploring ourselves is crucial. Doing it, identifying with another, in my case, alcoholic, another addict or another alcoholic, and sharing that experience after you're sober and clean so that you can help the next person who comes along that needs that help is the whole key to this thing. I wouldn't be sober 11 years today if it wasn't for all of these types of efforts. And there's a great deal of grace involved. It's not about religion, but in the course of doing this, this connection has sort of a spiritual component that you can't define or explain. You just have to experience it. But it works, and it works as a community, and that's very cool. So I'm enjoying the program. Thank you all for doing this.
Thank you very much for calling and sharing your story, Stephen. So, Brandon George. Community seems to be a huge part of this. Not only, you know, recovery is also, as Brandon Dryman pointed out, important, you know, as the thing that you want to recover. But it sounds like for you to get there, you have to enter into a new sort of community, the community of the people who are dealing with this, who are battling it. Is that correct?
It certainly was in my case. And most people I think that I see that are, I don't want to say successful, but that are able to get healthy again and really have get into recovery, do have support systems and beyond just the family unit that a lot of people think about and the larger recovery community. And there's multiple options out there. Kelsey made the mention that, you know, individuals really have to find what works for them. But for me, the idea of being able to get into recovery without that community, I really just can't. I can't imagine that almost. You know, I'd done so much damage to my relationships, to my friends, to my community, that I was very much pushed off to the side. I wasn't welcome at a lot of stuff. So being able to be around people that accepted me for who I was it was really refreshing, and it reminded me that people cared about me, that people loved me. And I never doubted that, you know, my family loved me, but there was a lot of separation there. And so being engaged with a group of people really taught me about love and compassion and self-worth and what I consider to be vital components of anybody in recovery.
We are talking about the importance of sharing recovery stories today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. My guests are firefighter Brandon Dryman, Indiana Addiction Issues Coalition Director Brandon George, and Kelsey Phillips, who works at IU Health and has been in recovery since 2013. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. In partnership with Side Effects Public Media, we're continuing our community conversation about public health today. We're talking about the importance of sharing recovery stories. My guests are firefighter Brandon Dryman, Indiana Addiction Issues Coalition director Brandon George, and Kelsey Phillips, who works at IU Health and has been in recovery since 2013. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Ben has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Ben, you're on the air.
Thanks, John, for taking my call.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I any program I hear on NPR at all about recovery, I, you know, crank it up, I guess you could say. I love listening in. I got into recovery about 2 years ago, and I stopped drinking alcohol. That was, you know, my advice. But and the importance of hearing stories is, in my experience, that is the reason for recovery was hearing other people's stories. When I went in the first, you know, interaction where I was around people and listening to their stories, it was going around a circle in the room, and I was probably about three quarter of the way through the circle. And by the time that it got to me, I was about speechless. And I just said, this is what I've been wanting to hear my whole life. So these people that talk, and these are the kind of people that I want to be, and some kind of people that I have always pictured as respectful people. I said, I'm in the right place. And since then, you know, I haven't drank since then. And actually ended up quitting smoking, which was a nice plus. But my life today is just indescribably wonderful. I can't describe it. And a large part of it is a spiritual component. It's just, I really can't describe how great my life is today. And, you know, for anyone listening that may have, you know, any issues, I think it's very important, the whole concept of taking things one day at a time, because, you know, for some people, the thought of maybe not drinking or any sort of drug, ending that and saying, what's the rest of my life I can't drink? Well, you know, if you kind of take it one day at a time and just, I can almost as well as guarantee, at least in my experience, that it'll work out. And but thanks for taking my call, John.
Oh, certainly, Ben. I saw Brandon Dryman nodding his head in affirmation while you were talking, so we're going to go to him. Thank you again for calling, Ben.
Thank you.
Brandon.
Yeah, Ben really hit it on the head, and it's come up time and time again, that isolation, that connection. And I think that in programs I went through, Alcoholics Anonymous, and that, to me, exactly what he described is my experience as well, that you feel so isolated, you feel so alone that I can't come forward with this. I'm the only person who feels this way. The things that I've done, nobody else can relate. Everyone's going to be sitting in judgment of me, and everything closes in. And once you get into that room and you hear other people around you with similar stories and similar experiences, it lets you know that you're not alone, that you really aren't that isolated. And it has the added benefit of seeing people in that room who have been sober for sometimes many, many years, which also gives you hope that this works and this can work for me. And if I follow this program, then this might be the key. So again, it's that isolation and reconnecting and the fellowship that can be gained from programs like this that makes a difference. And so many of these programs are storytelling at their root. That's what we do. We go around the table and we tell our story for other people to hear. And that's very empowering, not just for the speaker, but even more so for everyone else in that room listening to that story.
The other part of Ben's thing, Kelsey, that I found intriguing was, you know, talking about one day at a time, which I've always found to be, you know, a fascinating approach, because it strikes me that it does at least two things. One, you know, it reminds us that we're supposed to live in and appreciate this moment, the, you know, where we are right now, you know, not look back too much, not look forward too much any more than we need to. But the other part, in the context I think he was talking about, I remember years ago that when, to use the Billy Joel song lyrics, when I wore a younger man's clothes and I ran marathons, you couldn't run a marathon by thinking, oh, I'm going to go out there and run 26.2 miles. You just thought about running to the next water stop, basically, that's what you stayed focused on. You didn't let the immensity of it knock you down. Could you talk a little bit about how important, you know, that concept of one day at a time, or taking it in present tense, is important?
I think, you know, there's a reason that you hear that phrase, one day at a time, or just for today, so often. You know, it's absolutely that I can do anything for a day at a time. And in the beginning, that might not be true. Early on, there was a time when I could do anything for 1 minute at a time or for 1 hour at a time. And that makes everything more manageable. You know, one of the things that I hear sometimes is, you know, I don't know if I can go the rest of my life without getting high. I don't have to go the rest of my life without getting high. I have to not get high today. And that, I think also it's important, you know, for people who have this disease or who are in recovery. This is not a foreign concept, but I think sometimes people who don't have this disease don't understand that, you know, if I get high today, there's a good chance I'm not coming back for a while because I can't stop. You know, I have a disease that makes me not be able to mm-hmm. stop if I start. And if I can stay clean through whatever it is today, you know, it could be anything. It could be nothing. But if I can just stay clean today, then tomorrow I have an opportunity. If I get high today, I have no opportunities tomorrow. You know, it'll be a while it'll be a while before I find another opportunity to not pick up.
Brandon George, I think we've gotten to the moment where probably we've talked about the importance of sharing and established why they're therapeutic for both, you know, the listeners and for the person who's telling the story. But I think we've gotten to the time when it's important to share the story itself. Would you be willing to share your recovery story with us?
Yeah, I would be happy to. For me, my addiction set on at a young age. You hear a variety of stories. Some people get through school, they build careers, they lose it all. For me, it kind of went off the rails before it ever began. I started using drugs, drinking at an early age, 13, 14 years old, and I couldn't make it out of high school. I was kicked out of high school, multiple of them, some of them for missing because I couldn't show up. And back then, I was thought of as a bad kid that was lazy, that I couldn't make it to school. Nobody maybe recommended that I might have an issue with drugs and I needed an assessment because there might be a problem there. It was looked at much more of a moral or a behavioral issue versus maybe me being sick. Mm-hmm. And that's just how we handled it then. And luckily, that's evolving a little bit. But wasn't able to complete high school. I had friends of mine who were murdered when I was 17 years old over some cocaine I was involved in. So really negative consequences really early on. That's kind of the definition we have for addiction, is continued use despite negative consequences. Mm-hmm. It's against human behavior, right? You touch the stove when it's hot, you never do it again. And something clearly is kind of perverted if we continue to go back and touch that stove. So I've got these negative consequences, kicked out of school, friends who are passing away. Ultimately, I wouldn't be able to hold a job. It would lead to homelessness and living in a laundry room for 6 months. And just a complete and utter inability to stop doing things that I never thought I would do, getting arrested, stealing from family. You know, nobody ever wakes up and says, you know, today's a great day for me to steal from my grandmother or my mother or my wife or my wife's family. It's just it's a gradual process, and things become more acceptable as the addiction takes more hold. And, you know, I ended up being an IV, a crystal meth and heroin user. And it took me to some really dark places. And luckily for me, a little bit over 10 years ago, I was arrested actually for not pulling over for the cops. And what I thought was the worst day of my life ended up being the first day in the recovery process for me. You know, after spending a few days in jail, I was able to get into a residential treatment facility and then into a recovery residence for a period of time, and was able to treat some of the underlying issues. You know, we've talked a lot about recovery today, and I'm glad we're talking about recovery because that's the goal. Usually the focus is on treatment, and treatment is really more of a conduit to recovery. We need it. Mm-hmm. It's important to deal with trauma, to deal with all the baggage that we have and the underlying issues, but the goal is to get into recovery, and those organizations I was at gave me some great treatment, got me plugged into a recovery community. And since then, I've been able to go back to school, get my GED. I got a degree in human services. I've got another degree in addictions counseling. And now I get to run a statewide advocacy group that helps promote what we're talking about today. So it's been an amazing process.
And I'm going to move around, obviously, but a couple of questions. Brandon, George, I got to make that clear. First, can you recall, you know, you said you started drinking and using when you were 13 or 14 years old. Can you recall kind of what drew you to using at that age? What were the circumstances?
So twofold. I was working in a restaurant at the time at 14 years old, and all of the people that – I don't want to be negative on the restaurant business. It's all industries, whether it's construction or sales. But that's what we saw people doing, and so it was appealing to us. People had parties on weekends. They were having fun. And then I also had some friends that had some older brothers that were smoking marijuana, that were – drinking, and it was intriguing to us. People were having fun when they were doing it. They were listening to loud music. They were, you know, girls were coming over, and it was exciting. The idea of it was exciting.
What led you to start on the path to recovery?
It was a process. It's not recovery isn't a linear process. It's not A to B necessarily. And
yeah, it's more A to D, back to B.
Absolutely.
Somewhere off to some other numbers rather than I get it.
No question about it.
It's zigzaggy.
So when, you know, the first time I realized I had a problem, I was having problems at my I didn't connect the childhood stuff, but when I was older, around 20, I started realizing that I had a problem. I was paying consequences at work. And I started, you know, telling my family, you know, hey, I think I have an issue here. And that was my first time into any type of treatment process. And I went to a treatment provider for a week and came back out. And after 6 months, I thought I was better. And it really started a revolving door. I think that I've been into 8 or 9 inpatient places, 6 different places for a total of 8 or 9 times. And really, I was learning a little bit, trying something, learning a little bit, trying something. And learning process each time. It wasn't one of those places that worked. It was a culmination of them. And being alone and in despair, and my life had fallen apart, is what motivated that.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the importance of sharing recovery stories. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Sean has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Sean writes, if we are serious about ridding addiction from our society, then showing hard liquor or any alcohol commercials on TV and allowing Sunday sales is just making things so much worse. I think that the alcohol companies are just a wounded animal, alarmed, and have a sense of desperation by the growing trend of marijuana legalization around the world, the only real competition they have had in decades. Let's deal with the alcohol part of that. I mean, we have obviously banned cigarette ads for coming up on a half century now on commercial television. Is it a good idea to allow that kind of advertisement for you know, addictive substances, Kelsey?
You know, I hadn't considered this much, but I do think it's important for us to recognize that while everyone is, you know, looking off to the left at opiates and very concerned about this, you know, opiate crisis, alcohol kills more people every day. And, you know, working in a hospital, I see that happening in real time every day. I think the problem is at its core is that this is a disease that is progressive, and we're not influenced by ads. We're not influenced by the lack of ads. You know, people still smoke even though we don't advertise it. Ideally, I think maybe the glorification of drinking. I think about it a lot with this kind of mom wine culture thing that's mm-hmm. taken over on the internet, and it's alarming, I think, the normalization of heavy drinking. But ultimately, I don't know that that's going to do a whole lot to rid our society of addiction.
We are talking about the importance of sharing recovery stories here on No Limits. Norm, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, sir, and thank you for taking my call. And good afternoon to the panel as well. As you said, my name is Norm. I'm a recovering addict. I just celebrated my 24th year in recovery, October the 24th, to be precise. So I'm actually starting to live in my 25th year. On the one thing about stories is something that I learned being in the rooms is that eventually you will hear your own story. You'll hear it drop out of the mouth of another person that's suffering. That's out there in the madness. You know, you come in the room and you'll hear it. You'll hear it come from you might hear it from a woman. You might hear it from an older guy or a younger guy. But you will hear your story. And when you hear it, you know it, because the definition of all of it is still the same. And then I'd like to also comment on the commercials and this, that, and the mm-hmm. other. On the individual that wrote the email, I think it's neat that they're noticing that, but I agree with the young lady that just spoke. No, see, drugs and alcohol is only the symptoms of the disease. It's not the catalyst. It's something else. You know, I used to would say that my name is an addict, and my problem is Norman, mm-hmm. because that's what it is. It's when you learn, and it takes time, but after a while. It does become easier. I will say that it becomes much easier. You know, I don't have the cravings or anything like that anymore. That has left me. But I do know that if I start being complacent about where I am today in my recovery, I can just look out the window, and by the grace of God, there go I, walking right down the street in front of me, or driving right next to me. I tell you one last thing, and then
we're coming up on a break here. We're coming up on a break, Norm, so please be quick.
Real quick, I was just going to tell you, one thing I don't like is the bars in movie theaters. That's kind of interesting, but I'll take everything else off the air.
Thanks very much, Norm. You've given us a lot to talk about. We are talking.
Thank you.
Thank you. We are talking about the importance of sharing recovery stories today on No Limits. My guests are firefighter Brandon Dryman, Indiana Addiction Issues Coalition Director Brandon George, and Kelsey Phillips, works for IU Health and has been in recovery since 2013. We're going to respond to Norm when we come back. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today as part of our ongoing community conversation about public health, about the importance of sharing recovery stories. My guests are firefighter Brandon Dryman, Indiana Addiction Issues Coalition director Brandon George, Kelsey Phillips, who works for IU Health and has been in recovery since 2013. Just before we went into the break, we had a listener named Norm call in and share. It sounded like an abbreviated version of his recovery story and his observation. Because we were bumping up on the break, we didn't give the folks here in the studio a chance to kind of respond to Norm. I'm going to give everyone a crack at that. I'll start with Kelsey.
Yeah, I want to start by saying congratulations to Norm on 24 years. That's incredible. You know, I think that he really hit something that I think is really important, and I think it's a big reason why we have to pay attention to the idea of stigma and being vulnerable and telling our stories is that, you know, recovery tends to be a lifetime situation. Most people are not able to just stop using and be done forever. And I think that when we put a lot of stigma on the idea of being an addict or an alcoholic, we really pressure individuals into getting better as quickly as possible. And that's for most people, that's just not a reality. So I think that's really important for us to tell our stories.
If I could, I think those who are familiar with these kinds of discussions know this, but it's probably in case there are people out there who are visiting this subject for the first time. Why is it important to say I'm in recovery rather than I have recovered? Kelsey, you're looking at me.
I think it's just important because I'm always recovering, you know, and Norm really hit on this in his call, but if I become complacent in my recovery, you know, I didn't stop getting high because I didn't like drugs. Mm-hmm. I stopped getting high because I didn't like consequences. But when my consequences go away, I'm short-sighted, right? I'm very nearsighted in this issue. And when my consequences go away, I don't necessarily forget that I like drugs. And if I'm not always, you know, engaging in the connection that we've been talking about, if I'm not always working on becoming a better version of myself, I can get lost and remember how much I like to get high.
Brandon, I'm going to bring it back because I can see the clock marching along here. And the point of doing this is to share and show the importance of sharing recovery stories. Would you mind sharing yours with us?
Oh, I'd be happy to. Mine stems from volunteer work as well as professional work in fire and EMS. I became involved in fire and EMS when I was 16. And at 18, I became a certified EMT. And one of my first calls as an EMT was on a family member. My great uncle had suffered a gunshot wound to the head, and I got the call. And that was a very traumatic introduction to EMS, to say the least. He ultimately died, and that's something that I carried for a long time. And that's certainly one of many traumatic situations I've been in as part of that. And I used alcohol as my coping mechanism, as is frequently done in emergency services. The stats are pretty astounding for alcohol use in the fire service and abuse. About 30% of firefighters have alcohol use disorder as compared to 6 to 6.5% of the general population. So it's very high. But I think for me, that was my coping mechanism. I didn't want to talk about it. I didn't want to show the vulnerabilities that we keep bringing up. I didn't want to show the anxiety or the fear or the sadness. So I covered it up with alcohol. I've been with the Indianapolis Fire Department for a little over 17 years. And 6 years ago, I got called down for a random drug screen. And I never drank on duty, and that was part of how I justified to myself that I didn't have a problem because I never drank on duty. But I had drunk well into the night before that and had a positive breath test. And got suspended, but I was given the option to enroll in our employee assistance program, which ultimately I think saved my career, my marriage, and probably my life. But that was a real benefit that I had, to have access to high-quality behavioral health care, which isn't something that everybody has, and I've been very fortunate with that. And as part of my recovery, I wanted to see, what can I do to help other people? I know I'm not the only firefighter who has this mm-hmm. problem, and I got involved in peer support, and now I'm the coordinator for firefighter wellness and support with the Indianapolis Fire Department, something that 10 years ago I would have never imagined doing or being able to do. But and that's part of, I think, the importance of telling your story to others, so that they can hear where you come from, they can relate to that. But it also gives you that chance to give back. It's a service opportunity, which I think for most people in recovery is key, to be able to give back. How can I help someone else? Sobriety is the gift we keep by giving it away. How can I help someone else get in recovery? And I've been able to do that full time for a little while, and I'm just really appreciative of that.
And I realize with this question, I've got to walk kind of a fine line, because, one of the dangers I know with addiction is that you can offer up rationalizations for the behavior. But I've always thought, I'm not shocked at all, that firefighters have a higher incidence than the general population, because the whole nature of sort of being isolated from, family and even friends in the firehouse for, long stretches of time with not a whole lot to do but sit around and wait for something bad to happen and then go out and try to deal with what's bad. Are there certain professions, occupations, circumstances that create greater instances of or incidences of addiction? I'll start with Brandon Dryman on that one, but if anyone else has an answer, I'd be happy to take it.
For me, I think any high pressure, high anxiety field, whether it's law enforcement, EMS. I'm also went to law school, and I practiced law for a little while. I was a deputy prosecutor, and addiction is rampant in the legal field as well, mm-hmm. as well as medicine and dental practices. So I don't know if it doesn't discriminate. I think that's the bottom line. I think we see more of it in certain professions because they're high pressure and maybe environments where you don't feel comfortable saying that I'm vulnerable. But certainly the idea of addiction does not discriminate from one population to the next. So I think the more we're aware of that, the better off.
Kelsey, would you share your story with us?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I was just kind of a run-of-the-mill junkie, like what people imagine a junkie to be. I lived on the streets. I was a young person that really didn't like myself, it really led downhill very quickly.
If I could interrupt, because I think that's important. There are, for many of us, being a young person who doesn't like herself or himself is pretty much a definition of adolescence. What was it you didn't like about yourself? And, what was it? Same sort of question, I guess, I asked Brandon George. What first drew you to thinking that drugs and or alcohol would be a solution to that?
I think what I didn't like about myself, if nothing else, and this is something I hear all the time from people who struggle with these kinds of issues, is that it just felt like there was something different about me. I didn't belong anywhere. I grew up kind of in isolation, I felt like, anyway, and I couldn't find people who seemed to be like I seemed to be. And I'm not even, it's a process falling into the hole of addiction. It just happened really quickly for me. I started using late in high school, and by my early 20s, before I was 20 years old, I was pregnant. I remember going to my mom and telling her I'm pregnant, and then a week later coming to her and telling her, I'm also a heroin addict. And again, kind of like Brandon Dryman just emphasized, that's one of the reasons I think it's so important to tell my story, because it took me a very long time to get clean, mm-hmm. because I didn't think that any other women had experienced those things. I thought I must be the worst. I didn't hear a lot of women talking about having children and using during pregnancies or having children born into withdrawal. And I thought, I must just be a one-of-a-kind monster. Maybe I can't get better.
What was it like when you found out that you weren't one-of-a-kind? I mean, what was... can you recall that feeling when realizing, no, I'm not the only one who has dealt with this?
You know, so one of the things I hear all the time in recovery, too, is that we should look for people who have what we want. And the one thing that I wanted was to be lovable. And I found someone who could help me who had that and was in recovery. And finding that other people accepted me, finding that there were other people that were, even if their story wasn't exactly the same as mine, not being alone is a powerful tool. Mm-hmm. And Brandon George hit on this too, is like knowing that people can respect me and like me and care about me is a big deal.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the importance of sharing recovery stories. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named John has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. John, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much for having me, and thanks so much to the entire panel for sharing their important stories. I consider myself a recovered alcoholic, and I called in because I'm actually in the healthcare field. The healthcare field has been, you know, woefully behind when it comes to addiction treatment and recovery. So that really makes these personal stories so important. But one thing that I'd like to, for the panel, you know, to consider, or just for the audience to consider, is that medicine is coming along and doing the research necessary to learn what are some of the best modalities, and that, you know, if going to a program that's held in the basement of a church or something like that isn't something that appeals to people, speaking with your physician is really important because it is possible to recover, you know, with the help of the medical field. And I just don't want that to be lost on the audience.
Thanks very much for the call and for sharing that, John. Brandon George.
Yeah, thanks for the call. And it's an important point that's being brought up. You know, addictions, alcoholism has been separated off from the medical field for quite some time now. We've treated it as a criminal justice issue, as a moral failing for decades and decades and decades. And, you know, thank goodness for some of the programs in the basements and the other places that were able to fill a gap when the medical community wasn't as engaged here. The good news is there's a lot of work being done. And as a society, as we try to really drive home that this is a disease, this is a disorder, a chronic condition that needs ongoing care, it's going to be a big ship to start turning. Mm-hmm. But they are coming along. And I think primary care has a crucial role. I'm glad that he mentioned, you know, go to your physician, mention it. But we need a lot of education there as well. As an advocacy group, this is a big, huge area that we're aware of. You know, most doctors, according to a Harvard study, get about an hour of addictions training throughout medical school. And that's just incomprehensible to me right now, given what's going on. So it's coming. People are working on it. But it's going to be a while before we turn that ship, I think.
We've gotten a couple of related questions. One comes from a listener named Mary that says basically she wants to know what part do genetics play in addiction. Or, you know, that there is evidence now, obviously, that some people – Kelsey's nodding her head, so I'm going to go with her – you know, that some people do have a genetic predisposition to addiction.
Well, with lots of atypical – developmental issues in the brain, you know, there are people can be genetically predisposed, mm-hmm. and that does happen. That's a thing. And then, given the right set of circumstances, it can awaken those things. Generally speaking, I think in the recovery communities and even in the treatment world, because I am a part of that world professionally, you know, we worry so much less about why and now what. You know, we're here now what? And I think that's where where medicine is going to be an interesting, it's going to be interesting to see how Brandon's giant ship starts turning, because it is very much like boots on the ground. What do we do now?
Well, and how many icebergs it has to hit along the way before it gets there. We've gotten an email question from a longtime listener. It says, longtime listener caller that deals with this also issue of kind of comparisons. Says, great topic. What I learned in working a 12-step program, we don't know what we don't know. I learned that often. There is a genetic predisposition to alcoholism. My father, grandfather, brother all eventually died from alcoholism. It's not how much you drink or what kind of alcohol one drinks. I was a periodic drinker, and all my friends drank more than I. They did not suffer the negative consequences, as mentioned by one of your guests. If you are a beer drinker and you switch to wine, it's like changing deck chairs on the Titanic. The outcome will be the same. If you are an alcoholic, thanks as always for addressing these important issues for our communities. Brandon, did that seem to be speaking to you?
Yeah, there really is no safe substitute for a lot of these things. And it's important to note, too, that a lot of times we talk about addiction kind of in isolation, like that's the problem, the use of alcohol. And it's important to recognize that co-occurring addiction or co-occurring disorders can be a part of this, too. Like, are you using that substance to cover up something else, some pain from the past, some anxiety disorder, PTSD, depression? And I think sometimes maybe we think, well, I can switch to another type of alcohol, a less hard type of alcohol, and that'll be an improvement. But we're still medicating that same problem. And stopping the drinking is important, but also getting with a behavioral health professional or your physician to say, where can you refer me? Where can I go to get some help with this underlying behavioral health problem so we can address these at the same time? Because these things don't happen in a vacuum. And in the population that I work with, we see a lot of that, a lot of co-occurring disorders. And getting those treated at the same time, I think, is crucial and something that has to be added to this conversation.
We are running out of time here, so I want to ask the three of you to do a couple of things. One, I can tell that there are people out there who still have questions, and we often continue this conversation on our Facebook page after we've gone off the air. Would the three of you be willing to continue talking to people if they have questions on Facebook, on our Facebook page through that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then the last thing is, I feel like we'd be remiss if there's someone who has been listening to this and is struggling with something right now and wants a way to make a change. How should they go about that, Kelsey, real quickly?
Reach out is the number one. Reach out. You can always call 317-962-8333. That's IU Health's Chemical Dependency Program.
That is great. I'd like to thank my guests, Brandon Dryman, Brandon George, and Kelsey Phillips, for what has been an important conversation. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.